The end of the space shuttle program has meant a bonanza for space collectors. Robert Perlman is founder of the website collectspace.com. That's the online source for space history and memorabilia. He told me traffic to the site is way up now that the shuttle is being retired.
Collectors like to collect in sets, and up till now, the space shuttle has been an open-ended program. And so collectors sort of stayed wary about getting involved with it. Now there are complete sets. You have 135 missions and 355 astronauts who flew on the space shuttle. And so you know what you need to collect, and you can create that checklist to go after.
All right, so what are the really hot items that collectors are looking at right now?
The top of the list is definitely items that flew in space on the space shuttle. Flags, mission patches, every crew designs an emblem to represent their mission, and some of those get flown. And then parts of the space shuttle itself, you see parts like their heat shield tiles or parts of their thermal blankets being sold as collectibles.
Is there anything aside from the standard patches and bits of the shuttle, is there anything kind of weird on there, any unusual items?
Well, the astronauts are allowed to take some personal items up with them of their choice, and there have been some unusual items taken over the years. There have been pieces of Mount Everest. There have been collectibles from favorite television shows and movies. Luke Skywalker's lightsaber flew on the space shuttle. There was a Buzz Lightyear 12-inch action figure that flew on the space shuttle. Amongst collector items, certainly I get a number of stares when I pull out what is called a UCD. It's a yellow piece of rubber, and UCD stands for urine collection device, and it's the undergarment they wear during launch.
There are people out there who would actually want to collect this?
I think so. Not used, obviously, but if it was flown and unused, what it does, I think, is we want to relate to what it's like to live in space. And so if we can find something that relates to our own lives, something that we have done ourselves but maybe in a different way, then I think it's something that's pursued by collectors. It's something that you can understand without having a long explanation given.
How much are collectors prepared to spend? I mean, give me a range of how valuable some of these items are.
They range in value. You can find items that flew in space for as little as $50. But there are rising prices. About 5 years ago, you could buy an American flag that flew on the first space shuttle mission, of which there were 10,000 on board, for about $500. Today, you're lucky if you can find it for less than $1,000. It also competes against the earlier memorabilia from the early space program, and those prices have risen over $500,000 and more.
Over $500,000 and more. Like, what kind of item would fetch that?
Something that's been to the surface of the moon and has been coated in lunar dust and was obtained legally. Certainly would...
a key factor,
Yeah, key in this, I mean, if you're going to collect the artifacts from the program, key to it is making sure that you have the chain of ownership to show that it was released by the government through the proper channels and can be owned legally, because NASA and the Office of the Inspector General do not care how much it sells on the market. If it's their property, they're going to come try to get it.
Thanks very much for talking to us.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
That's Robert Perlman. He's the founder of CollectSpace.com, an online source for space history and artifacts. And there's photos of some of the more popular collectibles on our website, npr.org. This is NPR News.
Comic-Con, the annual pop culture convention, begins today in San Diego. 125,000 people are expected to swarm the city, some in costume, to check out the latest comic books, movies, TV shows, and comedy. Comic-Con comedy. Say that five times fast as you listen to NPR's Nina Gregory.
Amongst the caped crusaders and masked men, there are those who come to Comic-Con not to don their alter egos, but to find the funny. Not funny pages, but funny people. Tucked away in the little rooms of the San Diego Convention Center, fans seek out panels and performances from their favorite comedians. Keith Phipps is the editor of the entertainment paper, The AV Club. He explains what kind of comedy works at Comic-Con.
For the last few years, it's kind of anything that can stir a cultish following has a home at Comic-Con. And certainly comedy is no stranger to cult followings from Monty Python on up.
One show that fits that cult comedy niche is Children's Hospital. It's a parody of hospital dramas on Cartoon Network's Adult Swim.
So it takes more than the healing power of laughter to perform a successful operation.
Yeah, sometimes it takes actual medical procedure.
Sometimes.
Rob Corddry is the show's creator and star. He talks about why he goes to Comic-Con.
I have to be honest about it. I guess my involvement in Comic-Con is more parasitic than anything. Like, I am going there, you know, A, to have fun, and B, to, yeah, hopefully get more viewers for my show.
Corddry will be on a panel where fans can ask him questions. And this is part of the draw. Fans get to see sneak peeks and exclusive performances. They get to connect with the people who make and star in these shows. And they get to meet other fans. Again, Keith Phipps.
There's sort of nothing like sharing space with people who have your same obsessions. And whether that's, you know, comic books or Children's Hospital, Comic-Con seems to find room for everyone.
Well, not everyone. Comedian Kurt Metzger is on Ugly Americans. That's an animated comedy horror series on Comedy Central. Metzger plays an unemployed and undead zombie roommate. Despite this pedigree, he says fans at Comic-Con can be tough critics.
There's a certain kind of nerd that's like a real Robespierre type, you know, where they start out like kind of effete and weak seeming, but then once they have a little bit of power, they're just vicious. You know, because it just bugs me. I mean, I thought we were all nerds and we're not like that.
Oh, but in the modern day French Revolution, that is the blogosphere, these nerds do have the power to behead. And of course, leave it to the comedians to then reject Comic-Con.
Everything we try to do is a rejection of everything else. So we can't just say, oh, well, we finally found our little home at Comic-Con. We have to find our home at Comic-Con and then reject it.
That's Tim Heidecker. He and Eric Wareheim are the stars of the Adult Swim show, Tim and Eric Awesome Show, Great Job. Yes, that's the show's actual title. And despite the fact that its surrealistic style of comedy is practically tailor-made to suit the discriminating tastes of Comic-Con goers, Tim and Eric rejected Comic-Con. They took up residence at a nearby park where they staged their own makeshift convention, AwesomeCon. And their loyal fans followed. And that's a great thing about Comic-Con. The pleasure is in finding the funny, whether in a small room or a park down the street. Nina Gregory, NPR News.
And now we're going to step out of the Oval Office and head over to the barber shop where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in their chairs for a shape-up this week are author Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney and editor Arsalan Iftikhar, Republican strategist Ron Christie, and NPR sports correspondent Mike Pesca. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, fellas, welcome to the shop. How we doing?
Hey.
What's up?
All right.
Well, all right. Well, let's get some things started. Yo, Michelle, what's good with you? You had any interesting interviews lately?
Mm.
And right,
one or
right.
Two.
Yeah, props for scoring that conversation with the commander in chief. Good luck on you.
Well, thank you. Well, now we know what the president wants for his birthday: a deal on the debt ceiling. We know that Congress has less than 2 weeks to reach a compromise, and I don't know if the Congress is willing to hand the president what he wants for his birthday. We do know that the Senate has rejected the so-called cut, cap, and balance plan that the House Republicans, or that the House has already adopted. The Senate's rejected that 51-46. So I don't know.
Well, thanks for that, Michelle.
It's hot, you know, here. It's very hot.
Right. Right. And you know what's interesting to me? I read Obama's piece, President Obama's piece yesterday in USA Today. And at least, you know, because I'm always razzing him because he kind of rides the middle. But I have a sense that at least he knows that he's not going to be able to make people happy. You know, he's in a no-win situation. And nobody wants him to compromise. But that clearly would be in the best interest of the country as far as I'm concerned. Ron, RC, you're up first, man. What do you think?
Well, I think we're at a critical stage in the negotiations. I think that President Obama and the Democrats, from everything that I've been hearing from my friends who are behind the scenes on this, are insistent on a tax increase. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's what can get 218 votes in the House of Representatives. And I don't think any measure with a tax increase attached to it is going to pass the House. And I just worry that this brinksmanship has come far too late. We've had all year to deal with this, and the president and the Democrats have really not wanted to focus on this until, I'd say, about the last 3 or 4 weeks. And we could have some really catastrophic consequences if they don't get their act together in D.C. and fix this problem.
A-Train, what's your take?
Yeah, I mean, you know, just piggybacking off what Ron said, you know, for me, you know, for those of us like Michelle and I who live here in D.C., it has become gamesmanship. I mean, I'm sort of reminded of sort of the NFL, NBA lockouts. You know, these are, you know, essentially games of chicken, you know, blinking contests, you know, trying to get to the 23rd hour and 59th minute and eventually, hopefully, you know, cutting a deal. We saw that with the NFL owners, which we'll talk about. But, you know, there seems to be too much political grandstanding right now, and I think they're just waiting out the clock until the 23rd hour, and I think something will ultimately get done.
Well, yeah, here's the thing. Well, I don't know. I'm just wondering, though, is that really a fair analogy, though? How do you assess what's gamesmanship, and how do you assess what is, in fact, conviction? You know, conviction informed by ideology, which is not trivial,
right,
and political realities and a sense of, I mean, I guess well, in divided when government, you, I don't understand when, how when, we can when, argue when that one side or the other is being more intransigent
sure.
Because, in fact, it's divided government. Because
it is
because
divided.
The same voters,
right.
American citizens who voted for, you know, for the House Republican majority, and they also voted for the Democratic majority in the Senate, and they voted for this president. So it's not like, you know, aliens voted for one side or the other. These are all citizens who all obviously, in my view, sort of voted in good faith because of what they believe is right.
Right.
So,
but when it's perceived that political ideology is trumping the greater national interest, you know, obviously our country on the brink of, you know, governmental default is something that is pretty cataclysmic, you know, in an economic sense. And so, you know, we do have gamesmanship in the sense that, you know, people are sticking to their political orthodoxies in order to essentially, you know, move their agendas forward at the, you know, at the risk of hurting our country.
And I would also say,
well, hold on a second, but give the president props for not riding the middle. At least he knows that not everybody's going to be happy. Can we get MP in here?
This is, I know, Mike is definitely not happy. He's like, get a brother in.
Let's get Mike P in here, man. Welcome to the shop, man. How you living?
I'm all right. And let me first say that for my birthday 1 year, I wanted the Law of the Sea Treaty ratified. I got a Schwinn instead, so I was a little disappointed. On that point, I would say that gamesmanship and conviction aren't mutually exclusive. I mean, if you have conviction, what you want to service that conviction is the best strategies to get it done.
Right.
So, you know, you strongly believe in something and then you take it up to the 11th and a half hour. Now, I'm mostly a sports correspondent these days and I was assessing where we are with the NFL, which we'll get to. But it struck me as a lot different from the debt ceiling because with the NFL, the big dispute is how to split a record amount of revenue, $9.3 billion. With the debt ceiling, it's making tough choices. It's actually a little more like the NBA strike where they're not making money. So I would say on this hour, I mean, even though as citizens we despair at the fact that it seems like our congressional leaders and the executive are dithering, in fact, they're just trying to play it out to the best of their advantage. And so far, I mean, a deal could get done in a couple of days and it might be a fine deal. And the fact that it took so long is just a consequence of, you know, not a breakdown of the system. The fact that it took so long could just be, you know, both sides trying their best to get what they honestly believe is in the best interest of their people in the country.
Well, speaking of what took so long, that was NPR sports correspondent Mike Pesca, by the way. We're having our weekly visit to the barber shop with him, with author Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney Arsalan Iftikhar, and Republican strategist Ron Christie. So are America's most popular sport in jeopardy, Mike? So it seems like what?
Things are looking pretty good right now. 31 of the NFL's 32 teams have approved the deal. The Oakland Raiders, of course, being the exception like they always are. And now it's up to the players to figure out what they're going to do. Most indications are that the deal that was hammered was hammered out by the players' representatives. So there are details, and the players might not ratify it, or they might ratify it. It's seen as likely that they will. And my analysis of this whole thing, you know, It was hyper-scrutinized, but I don't think so much of it was so surprising. Each side played their cards. You try to decertify. You see what the courts say. Right. You let it all play out. And then it gets to the point where it's pretty clear that the message is, all right, here's where one side stands. Here's where the other side stands. And then they both say, you know what? Let's not lose millions of dollars. Let's make millions of dollars. So they get a deal done, which looks like where we're standing now.
Hey, wow, Jimmy. That sounds like divorce court.
Oh, snap. So, but Jimmy, you're the tweet guy, and you were telling us that a lot of the players have been tweeting that they're not happy with the proposed deal. I don't know. What do you think? You think they should take it?
I think they should take it. I think you know what? They get paid this amount of money, this exorbitant amount of money, it seems to us, but they've ruined their bodies for life, and I think they should fight for the money they want, and when the money comes across the table, I think they should take it and get back on the field and do what we try to pay them to do.
What
I think.
But, you know, Arsalan, you know that 75 former NFL players brought suit against the league for allegedly covering up important information about concussions.
Right.
And do you think that case has merit? You're our lawyer here.
I don't. I think this was more of an attempt by these 75 retired NFL players to, again, you know, keep the issue in the public zeitgeist. As you said, in the Superior Court of Los Angeles in California, 75 retired NFLers are suing the NFL for mismanaging concussions and also concealing evidence about the overall harmful effects of concussions. Now, this is the first legal action of its kind. It includes named plaintiffs like former Miami Dolphins wide receiver Mark Duper, one half of the Marx Brothers. Otis Anderson of the New York Giants, Vernon Dean of the Redskins. Basically, I don't think that they're going to be able to find any sort of causation between the NFL's, you know, studies and reports and the actual concussion stuff. But again, I think it's to keep things in the public zeitgeist.
Mike, just before we let you go, any different opinion on that? Do you agree with Arsalan on that, or do you think the case has merit?
The analogy being made is that it's a lot like the cigarette lawsuits, but most people forget that the vast majority of cigarette lawsuits lost, right. Mm-hmm. But the NFL, I would just say that Roger Goodell had a choice a couple years ago, either to fight what was a mountain of scientific evidence or to acknowledge it. And the downside, I say to his great credit, he's taking on the head injury issue head on. But mm-hmm. the downside to that was it does open you up a little bit to a suit. And if they had, you know, denied and strung it out and hired their own scientists to come up with different conclusions, you know, the suit might not have happened, or at least have happened this year. So it was a chance that Goodell took, and I think Goodell should be complimented for the league itself trying to get in front of the head injury issue. And the ripple of that is that lower level leagues, especially youth leagues, are now really taking it seriously. And this suit will draw attention to the fact that helmets that young players use are often terrible. Mm. And the standards for helmets, Schwartz of the New York Times has done a lot of investigative reporting into this. You know, if you have your kids playing football, make sure that they're not using these old reconstituted helmets, because the standards and the government that look over football helmets, it's really a lax oversight situation.
Okay, well, before we let you all go, talk about a contact sport. Hello. This week, Republican Congressman Alan West told Debbie Wasserman Schultz, she's the chair of the Democratic National Committee, she's also a Florida rep, that if she wants a fight, he's happy to oblige. So much for civility in the Sunshine State. West wrote these comments in an email to Wasserman Schultz when he calls her vile and despicable and tells her to, excuse me, shut the heck up. And this, he wrote this after she criticized him on the floor of the House for his stand on entitlement cuts. This is what she said on the floor. Here it is.
Incredulously, the gentleman from Florida, who represents thousands of Medicare beneficiaries, as do I, is supportive of this plan that would increase costs for Medicare beneficiaries. Unbelievable from a member from South Florida.
Now, there's just been, you know, I don't know what to call it, like flame on this, because there have been pieces from a number of writers, mainly women, saying that West is totally out of line. But Ron, you have a very different perspective on this. You think Wasserman Schultz was out of line.
Absolutely. She's been obsessed with Alan West even before he was a member of Congress. She was the one who organized a very disruptive campaign rally in front of his office when he was seeking his congressional seat. And the one thing I can tell you and your listeners, for having worked on Capitol Hill for nearly 9 years, is that it is against the decorum of the House to personally go after one member, to make reference to another member in the way that she did. And I would also add that what she said was 100% Not true. There was nothing in the House Republicans' cut, cap, and balance bill that would have affected Medicare. And so for her to say that there's a member from Florida and there was another thing, it was like a tornado through South Florida, and that he was going to adversely impact people on Medicare is a lie. And I'm tired of people who go out and try to scare seniors. And she's had a record of having gone after Alan West, and he said enough's enough.
Okay,
so
well,
I'm
more,
absolutely behind him.
There's more to it than that. And
yes,
it involves
is.
A motorcycle magazine, but I don't have time to get into that. But, but Arsalan, final thought?
You know, Ron, you're my homeboy, but Alan West is not. This is a man that was convicted of violating two counts of the Uniform Code of Military Justice while he was in the army in Iraq for shooting near the head of an innocent Iraqi police civilian officer against Democratic incumbent Ron Klein. He said that he wanted to take him behind the woodshed and give him a whooping. This guy said that Debbie Wasserman Schultz was not a lady. What if someone said that he is not black? I mean, the guy has put his foot in his mouth so many times he should open up a Payless shoe source.
Oh, no.
You're my man, but I disagree, my brother.
Okay. Well, thank you for keeping it civil, both of you. We'll have to leave it there for now. Jimmy Israel is a freelance journalist and author of the book The Denzel Principle. He was with us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. Mike Pesca is an NPR sports correspondent. He was with us from our bureau in New York. Joining him there, Ron Christie, a Republican strategist, former aide to President George W. Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney. And Arsalan Iftikhar is a civil rights attorney, founder of TheMuslimGuy.com and managing editor of The Crescent Post. Thank you all so much.
Peace out.
Bye. Yep, yep.